You're listening to highlights from One Planet Podcast's interview with Professor Michael Cronin. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
How have travel and writing about travel contributed to the ecological degradation of the planet? Conversely, what role has travel writing played in making readers aware of the climate emergency and the need to promote sustainable forms of engagement with a planet in crisis? To begin to answer these questions, we need to reflect on how travellers' perceptions of the environment have changed over the centuries. And I think that what we're entering now is the third phase of this evolution in writing about the planet from a travel perspective, which is we're beginning to ask ourselves questions as to what extent travel itself is bringing about the end of travel, that the environmental, the ecological consequences of mass air travel are having catastrophic consequences on the environment, consequences that are, of course, mainly borne at present by people who have contributed the least to this environmental crisis. So now I think we're moving from what I called in the first part of the book, the ends of travel, like thinking about what we might use travel for, to now the end of travel, question mark. To what extent can we still write about travel in the way we have up until now? I think the fundamental feature of the Anthropocene is that our relationship to what I call the more than human world has changed dramatically. The sort of paradigm that obtained in the West, this wasn't the same in other parts of the world, but in the West was very much the idea of a pyramid. And at the top of the pyramid, you had the sort of the white European male, and everybody else in the kind of was subordinate to this white European male. And the idea that was central to this pyramid was a kind of a mixture of the Judeo-Christian legacy and the Cartesian legacy. So basically what we find then is that the animals, the natural world, the living things in it, the rivers, the mountains, the forest, these become instruments of that we become, in Descartes' words, masters and possessors of nature. And this is what basically is called into question by the climate emergency. Because in the climate emergency, what happens, this is why we've got it. We talk about a new geological epoch, although still a bit of controversy about whether, in fact, we have actually arrived there. But what characterizes our world is that the sum total of human actions has the same force as a geological event. So the eruption of volcanoes, the shifting of tectonic plates, these are things that have traditionally, you know, had a huge impact on the Earth, on the environment. But now the sum total of human activities is having an equivalent effect. So what's happening, of course, is that alongside this, we find that the idea of a kind of an inert world that is simply there for our pleasure, enjoyment, and exploitation, it has proved to be catastrophically mistaken, because we see it with flooding, with forest fires, we see it with acidification of the oceans, we see it with a continuing rise in temperatures, is that the world itself, the more than human world, is fighting back. It has taken on its own agency. And that therefore, the idea of a pyramid, a hierarchy, is no longer operative. So what a number of what are called post-humanist philosophers have suggested is that we need to look at horizontal relationships, not vertical ones. So in other words, we have to see ourselves not in a hierarchical position with respect to the rest of the living world, but to see ourselves as in a symmetrical partnership with the plants, the trees, the forests, the animals, the microorganisms, etc. And so we have to think about not vertical relationships, the ones we're accustomed to, but to think about horizontal relationships. And that, if you like, is where the challenge comes. You find a great deal of historical accounts, geographical accounts, sociological accounts of mobility and displacement. But one of the things I noticed over the years, which, if you like, made me write a book on globalization in 2003 and on translation identity in 2006, was how remarkably absent language and language difference and language contact was from these stories of human mobility, despite the fact that one of the most fundamental experiences that humans have when they move from one space to the other is precisely the fact of language. Language is very, very fundamental to their experience. The point which relates, I suppose, to this question of linguistic relativism, what extent the languages we speak determine our vision of the world. And I think that the way that works for me in two ways. One is grammatical and the other is mnemonic. So let me start with the mnemonic first, the question of memory. One of the things that speaking a language does, and particularly when it's a language that's been spoken in a particular place for a very long period of time, for a continuous period of time, is that it immediately links you to the continuous history of that place. Because every time you see a place name, you see a name that not only describes a specific feature of the landscape, but it's also a place name that has stories associated with it. So there's a sense in which you situate yourself not in some kind of moment in the present where you're sort of cut off from all that's gone before you, but you're in a kind of continuous mnemonic relationship with that past. So that the past, both in an environmental, in a more than human and a human way, so human story and more than human environmental features of the landscape, they are present to you. And the other, which is to do with the more purely formal properties of the language, is that I notice with certain things in Irish, and so many of the words, the way we describe emotional states in Irish, are based on that notion of relationality and also based on the notion of change, of kind of continual evolution, transformation, and so on. So for me, I find it's those sort of dynamic properties of the language are most interesting in allowing one to have a different experience of the world. One of the things that has arisen in recent years in the area of political science is what they call post-Holocene governance. A traditional idea we've had with democracy is this kind of notion of the public sphere or deliberative democracy, where we're there, we engage with each other, we try and collectively decide what's the best thing for our group to further the interests of all the people in the group. This is the sort of the ideal. And of course, this notion of kind of a democratic ideal then gets critiqued by various groups saying, okay, so certain genders are excluded from this deliberative democracy. People of color have been excluded from this deliberative democracy. So you go to the various groups in order to expand this notion of what a genuine democracy is. But what many eco-activists are arguing now is that in order for us to live on our planet, we need to greatly expand our understanding of deliberative democracy to include the more than human world, to include all of the entities in this world that we share. So in order to do that, then, it seems to me that we have to think about forms of translation, forms of interpreting. Who is going to speak for the river? Who will speak for the man? So I can give legal personhood, as has happened in Ecuador, New Zealand, and elsewhere, to a river or a mountain or a forest. But then we have to think carefully about who is going to do the translating. And this is precisely where Indigenous peoples have such an important role to play. Because for centuries, Indigenous peoples have seen themselves as being involved in a translational relationship with the more than human world. They accord character and personhood to the different entities that they interact with. And therefore, it's a question of acknowledging the differences. It's not a question of pretending that you as human can just project everything onto the more than human world through kind of anthropocentrism, the Mickey Mouse view of the universe. But it's more the idea that you communicate across difference. You respect difference and you negotiate that difference. And it seems to me that that translational knowledge of Indigenous peoples in different parts of the world is something that we need to think about in terms of how we might develop a kind of translational politics for what's called post-Holocene governance. For example, rather than have a Security Council, you have an Earth System Council, where the different parts of the world with different sort of biomes that they would be represented at this Earth Council. But it wouldn't, of course, just be humans. It would be animals, living organisms, non-living organisms. So we have to think about the sort of the politics of representation, just as different groups, just as we've had to think about it over the centuries in terms of humans, we now have to think about it, I think, in terms of the different groups or categories in the more than human world. I think probably my most vivid memories are, I grew up in the south of the city, but I grew up near it called the Dublin Wicklow Mountains. And so I spent a great deal of my teenage years in particular cycling through these mountains. You get these remarkable kind of skies, cloud formations, and then what happens, the rain falls after the rain when the sun comes out. So it was intensely dramatic. It was intensely theatrical landscape. So that's what I remember most vividly, was the kind of the drama of this landscape and this world. And I think that sense of wonder that and a kind of just fascination and awe at the possibilities of this world, this seems to me the most valuable thing of all that any educational system can communicate. And I think this is what students should be demanding, that rather than this kind of contemporary obsession with skills, which is always a doomed project because the world is changing so rapidly that the kinds of skill sets that almost are invariably obsolete. But what I think will stay with you for an entire lifetime is to be equipped with the capacity and the tools to find wonder in the world. And that is to find a language for that world, which is supplied through a folktale, mythology, literature, poetry, and song, and then to also to have the kind of knowledge basis. I still think we suffer from this terrible division between the humanities and the science. These two worlds are sundered. Is I think we need to bring them. So I think we need to infuse a kind of a syncretic knowledge, but that would have as its central or its core point of value a rediscovery of wonder in the world. And of course, a world that you wonder at is a world that you cherish. And a world that you cherish is a world that you want to preserve. And that, I think, is our only hope.
We hope you've enjoyed this program and listening to the highlights of this podcast. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast or learn more about environmental projects, click on the subscribe button. Thank you for listening.